Inside, everything was very tight. They would run all the plumbing and ductwork and wires and cables. Everything was inside the modules, going module to module. We learned from that when the International Space Station was built, everything was built outside. That's why you have so many EVAs. Every time a new module goes up, they have to reconnect things. Ammonia lines, data lines, and so on and so forth. But with these people, they didn't quite have their act together, you know. But in 1995, the space station Mir was up for about 10 years. Out of the 10 years, they, according to the articles, they were only had occupied it for about a total of six years at that time. So, I mean, they were starting to think about deorbiting it then, but they didn't deorbit it until, I think it was 2000, 2001. Let me drop it. They had really two different launch facilities, Priyesk in the northern part of Russia, northeast of Moscow, and then they had Baikonur, which they still use today. That was the original one. That's where they launched Yuri Gagarin on his first orbital flight. And Baikonur is still being used today. The problem is that's located in Kazakhstan now, since the fall of the Soviet Union. They're paying rent to Kazakhstan to use that facility. So even back then, they started thinking, where can we put another launch facility? And they started thinking of this old place way northeast of Russia, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 miles east of it. And, you know, really like eastern Siberia, southeast of Siberia. So they came along with the idea to do something there. And at the time, reading this, it looked like, well, maybe they're not going to do it. It looks like it's going to be too expensive. Sure enough, today it's built, just 2 years ago. They finished a lot of launch complex. And by the way, the name of this new launch complex, they call it Voskochny. I talked about it here on the net when they were developing it. And when they launched their first rocket, they launched a Soyuz rocket from that location. And it was a successful launch. They haven't launched anything since, but they're working on it. They need to build this place up. They plan on making it a real city, thinking it, in the long run that they'll probably house like 50,000 people. And it's a way to develop their eastern part of Russia. But the most important part, they will get away from Kazakhstan. And they're trying to get away from Kazakhstan for launching rockets like we're trying to get away from the Russians. And that's one of the reasons we're building the Dragon spacecraft for SpaceX, which is private, and Starliner for Boeing, also private. Yeah, we still have a NASA program developing the Orion spacecraft, which is the one that will eventually go to cislunar and probably eventually to Mars someday. That's the government end of it. But privately, we plan on building these private rockets, which will be launched from Cape Canaveral in the beginning. So that's pretty much it for that. Quite a few other things, you know, they call, like, right now there's a place called Star City, and that's where all their cosmonauts and our astronauts will train before they all go up. You know, we send our astronauts up on the Soviet rockets. But back then they called it Starry Town. Starry Town was the name of it. Today it's called Star City. They didn't like it. Somebody, I guess, didn't like the name Starry Town.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
But they do the... They had an old type of third stage years ago. So you can see the differences from 1995 to now. They also used to launch a lot more rockets. They got up to about 100 per year. Now they're down to about 50 per year. So things have changed. Another rocket they were talking about then, again, it didn't look like it was going to be affordable to build, they said. Let me drop it. Was the Angara rocket. Our rock, another family of different rockets. They'll have medium to heavy lift vehicles. They've already launched two different types of Angara rockets. So what they were talking about as a possibility, but it don't look like we're going to have enough money, is somebody must have come up with the money in Russia, and these rockets are built. They will eventually carry people. So that's it. One interesting thing about the Mir, by the way, is their communications were terrible. They didn't have TDRS satellites, tracking data relay satellites like we have. So communications would be lost sometimes around 10 hours a day. And even Dr. Norm Thagard, the first American to go up to Mir, he's trained for everything. He realized that this is not a good thing. So they had ham radio on board. And they actually used ham radio to transmit important data back and forth. Every time he went over Houston, let me drop it. He would use amateur radio. Dr. Norm Thagard, astronaut, would use amateur radio to speak to Houston, and he might have told them, these guys might be ahead of us with the space station, but they got a lot of work up here. They had fires up there and all kinds of problems. So that's pretty much it. I want to thank you again for the article, Dick. Very well done. Glad you kept it all these years, and it's fun to compare the difference between 1995 and all these years later. Back to that, K2LIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Dick might have gotten away there for a minute, but I know he'll be back. Very good. A couple of other articles, other topics and paragraphs of the thing was pretty good. One interesting thing I liked was, while we wait for Dick to come back, is the Russian program at the time was so underfunded, and there were people that worked on the original parts of the space station and a lot of other parts of the space environment, old rockets and things. And they were getting older, and they were retiring, and they wouldn't pass the information down. They didn't take things with them. The next generation really wasn't getting filled in on what they were doing. And there were a couple of times when the cosmonauts were on the Mir spacecraft. They did have a television link, and they would hold up a piece that was inside one of the modules that was designed like maybe 10, 15 years ago, before 1995 when they were working on the Mir. And they would hold it up, and they would ask their mission control in Moscow, and when you're in Moscow, what is this piece? Stand by, we'll get back to you, in their Russian language. And they would go back to the crew and say, we'll get back to you. We're going to check with some of the people. They would call everybody. They would check, they would find people that worked for the space program decades ago to try to find out what this thing is. Let me drop it. And then, according to the article, a couple of days passed, and they radioed up to the crew. They told them, we have no idea what this thing is. Nobody down here knows what it is either. So, I'm paraphrasing the article, but basically that's what they were saying. Dick, are you out there? K2LIW, WS2. I guess not. Does anybody have any comments or questions until we get our leader back? This is WS2N. Yes, it's still early yet. Okay. I don't have any other comments. But we could review a couple of the flights that are in progress right now. If anybody wants to know what we're doing with New Horizon, which is still on its way past Pluto, or the upcoming destruction of the Cassini spacecraft, which is going to burn up in the Saturn atmosphere. It's been in orbit around Saturn since 2004, but it's starting to run out of fuel, and they don't want to have it destroy, you know, hit a moon and destroy itself and possibly contaminate that moon. The last thing they need to do is hit Titan or something. And then 10 years from now, send up another spacecraft, land on a thing, and look for microbes in the atmosphere on the land and find out that we're not sure if this is originally from the planet or not, because it might have been contaminated from the Cassini spacecraft. So rather than have it accidentally hit a moon, they're going to deorbit it and let it burn up in the Saturn atmosphere. And they did the same thing. This has been done before with the Galileo spacecraft. They spent quite a few years orbiting Jupiter, I think 5 or 6 years of active operation. And they did the same thing. They didn't want that to accidentally crash into Europa.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Pretty way, great way to go. Come in at 100,000 miles per hour and just burn up and that was it. All gone. Well, they did that with they had a probe on Galileo. The probe eventually burnt up. They sent it into the clouds of Galileo when it first got there. Cassini had a probe as well. But that was a fancy one. That had a lander on it, and they landed it on the moon Titan successfully. And to this day, it's the furthest landing of a vehicle on another body from Earth or the sun. So they hold that to this day. I mean, it's been other landings. We drop it. There's been landings on asteroids. We landed something on Eros once called Near. The European Space Agency, they landed a spacecraft called Philippe using the mothership called Rosetta to land on an asteroid, correction, a comet, a couple of years ago. But all of those are in a lot closer than Saturn. So, let me see if Dick is back. K2RIWWS2N.
WS2N, AC2LR.
AC2LR. Good evening, Kay. How are you? And have you followed this rather long description of the tonight's Space Net? Back to you, Kay.
Hi, yes. And as you were talking about SpaceX, I went to the website and I just was poking around and I see that they are looking to hire RF system engineers. And all you need is a bachelor's in some kind of engineering and experience with antennas and certain kinds of software. And they're based in Hawthorne, California. Those two jobs would be there. If anyone's looking for a job and you have those experience qualifications, check out SpaceX.com. And I also have a question about Juno for you, Paul. We're talking about that.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorite spacecraft, Juno. Still in orbit around Jupiter. I know you like that one. That was the one that we sent CW. Forget how many thousand operators. I know you were one. I was one. Sent to CW at the exact same time to check out if its plasma detector was working properly. And it was. That was pretty good. They got the amateur radio community involved. We had to send very slow CW. They gave you a whole system on how it was done or how you were to do it. And then after that, everybody that participated let them know. And it took them a long time. You know, they're busy people at JPL. And eventually they sent their QSL cards out. Not sure I had that one displayed. Hawthorne, yeah, California, that's where they headquartered out of. and SpaceX is up there doing a mission. Let me drop it. The communications between the spacecraft and Earth are going to Hawthorne, California. They're the ones that are directing it. They're the ones that are telling it what to do, when to do it. A lot of it's autonomous, but if there's a change or anything has to be done, they're the ones doing it. All the rockets, the spacecraft are developed out there and eventually shipped to wherever they have to go, either to Vandenberg Air Force to be launched or clear across the country. But they go down, they usually go to Texas first and get tested in Texas, and then they send them out to Florida to be launched. So that's going to be good. And Hawthorne, California, they have the original Dragon spacecraft that was put into space, that went up to the space station. And the first one that came back, you know, they come back on a parachute, so that one came back. And they have it displayed in the office, if you in their lobby. So, you know, when you watch these space shots and they're talking from Hawthorne, California about what's going on, hanging up in the back, you see this Dragon spacecraft. Now, to add to that, they put a booster. Let me drop it. They put a boost to the first one to successfully land. And they brought that, actually landed on land in California, in Florida. And after reconditioning it and everything, they just brought it back to use as a display model rather than their ultimate goal is to reuse these things. But this is like, you know, first time ever anybody got one of these gigantic boosters to come back and land. You know, it's like almost like a 15-story building. They decided to display it outside their office in Hawthorne, California. And those people look like they're having a lot of fun when they have a space launch and they're all cheering in the background. And, they all look young, so if I come back my second life, I'll sign up with SpaceX. Oh, back to you, Jay. You had a question or a comment about Juno spacecraft.
Yes. Did you happen to know why Juno had to go all the way past the orbit of Mars before it came back to Earth for a gravity assist? Why not go some other direction, or why did it have to go that far? I know it went past the orbit of Mars and then did two sea-based maneuvers, I think they called it. I don't know what those were or why it did that either. And then it came all the way back. Why did it, you know, need to do that, you know?
Yes, well, as you know, Juno is a big spacecraft. It's heavy. It's a lot bigger and heavier than what we sent with Galileo all the way to Jupiter. And it was launched on an Atlas V. The configuration of the Atlas V was the 4-5-1 configuration. That meant 5-4-1. That means the biggest one Atlas has five. The first five is 5 meters in diameter for the top for the fairing to enclose the big spacecraft. And then you have the 5-5-1. So then the second five is five booster rockets, solid booster rockets to attach to this thing. That's the most that you can put on the Atlas V. And then the one standard number that's the amount of rocket engines that are on the second stage. So that's the biggest configuration. But even with that, it was so heavy they couldn't launch it all the way to. They didn't have enough velocity to go all the way to Jupiter. But they did have enough velocity to get out to about Mars. So they actually went around Mars and took some pictures. But then on their way back, they made course correction. And then they also accelerated more to heading back toward Earth. And the reason they're heading back toward Earth is they going to come up behind it, and as the Earth is moving, it's going to gain a gravity assist from Earth. So, you know, it goes out of that.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
At a time that, where we go over the North Pole of Jupiter, and then get caught into this, you know, kind of get caught into orbit around the planet that way from the north to the south. And presently it's still in a 53-day orbit. They originally wanted to get it down to a 14-day orbit, but then I was doing that. So I hope I answered the question, okay? Turn it back to you. I might have timed it out too long, I'm not sure. AK? I forgot the suffix. This is WS2N.
AC2LR. I remember it as always continue to love radio. Or anyone care to learn Russian? But I was wondering, were they actually trying to make it to Jupiter, and when they realized they couldn't, that's when they turned it around back to Earth, or they knew it was just going to go out past Mars and then come back to Earth? They planned it that way. AWS2N, AC2LR.
Oh yeah, they're pretty good at that. They planned it like that. You know, depending on the type of booster, you might have to do quite a few orbits around Earth. I know the MOM mission from India, that's the Mars Orbiting Mission, MOM, they sent to Mars. Still orbiting Mars, still doing good. I think that had to orbit Earth maybe probably 5 or 6 different times. So they would go out, go as far as they could, you know, a couple thousand, you know, maybe 30,000 miles out or something, and then it would start coming back. They'd accelerate because they're coming toward Earth, and, you know, at the low point. And then they would be able to use that extra acceleration to go further, you know, after 50,000 and then after 100,000. Eventually, they would get to the point where they would break free of the gravity well. So they had to do it quite a few number of times. So they all seem to have this down to system. That was their first shot out to Mars. They successfully made it by doing that. You know, you would like to, you know, just make a direct shot, for instance, New Horizon went all the way to Pluto in almost 10 years. They had a Atlas V as well with 5 boosters on it. Let me drop it. But of course, that weight was only, I think, I don't know, 1,500 pounds or something. So it was very light compared to multi-ton thing that we sent to Jupiter called Juno. So, you know, they didn't need any, you know, they didn't need to go around Earth a couple of times. They didn't need to go around the sun for a big gravity assist for Earth. They just shot out of here like there was no tomorrow. That was the fastest rocket that ever left Earth because it was lightweight and they had all these boosters attached to it. And that made a direct shot. They did have a gravity assist by Jupiter, but they didn't need to bypass Earth. They didn't need to return to Earth for a little extra help. Back to UK. I forgot your call. I don't know why. AC2LRWS2N.
Thank you. I also wanted to tell you that, remember when we were talking about asteroids a little bit on Craig's net last Tuesday? I had thought that we had never mined any asteroids, but someone told me this week that Japanese space program sent a mission, Itokawa, to an asteroid, and exploded something on it, made the material puff up, and collected the material that puffed up and brought it back. And another mission, I think, Hayabusa 2, I think, with materials. also that super valuable asteroid called Psyche. Has gold streaks and platinum and all that. When we're sending our mission out to search that, I don't know why we're not trying. It's just as far in the asteroid belt. Why we're not trying to bring back some of that material? It's possible and it's been done. Do you know anything about that? WS2N AC2LR.
Yeah, Japan had two missions that I know of. Maybe this one I'm missing, but two missions that I know that they went to asteroid, one Hayabusa 1, and one that's presently on the way called Hayabusa 2. Hayabusa 1 was somewhat successful. I mean, they went out to the asteroid and they collected, just very little what they caught up in the system that they had, very little, and they returned it, so they were successful, but They really wanted to get a lot more, so they improved on their spacecraft, and they just sent out Hayabusa 2. And I guess that didn't get there yet. I would have heard about that. And they'll do the same thing. So, as far as mining it, you mean sample return. And with the second mission, they probably hope to get a little bit something out of it. We've had a sample return of a comet called Comet Belt, WILD, used a spacecraft called Starduster, and that went out to that comet, and it had this tennis racket type thing that opened up, and it had something in it called aerogel was, very light stuff that would catch any kind of debris or anything that was near this comet, and that was successful. Passed the comet, picked up some stuff. They weren't sure what they had. The tennis racket went back into the compartment, into the spacecraft part of.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A little bit more stuff than they thought. Pretty good. To this day, they're still analyzing the stuff that came from a comet. Now, we're sending another one called OSIRIS-REx, which was launched at the end of last year. And that's going to an asteroid as well. Bennu is the name of it. Now, that's going to go there. Got this big ring type of hand at the end of the arm, and after orbiting for like a year around this asteroid, they're going to know where they want to go, and they're just going to come down and almost touch it, and then this hand with this ring on it is going to come out on an arm, and using nitrogen gas, they're going to push some nitrogen gas out, and the dust and everything is going to come up and it could go into the circumference of this ring and be sucked in into the up the arm and into part of the spacecraft that has the sample return part of the spacecraft. Again, that's going to return to Utah land over there. They'll analyze that. They'll come back very similar to Stardust. But they're the only ones that I know of. Other companies have more long-term plans. There's a couple of these people that are going to the moon at the end of the year or beginning of next year. Their long-term goals after taking pictures of the moon and landing successfully, plan on eventually going not only back to the moon to dig up material and use that for manufacturing. They plan on eventually going to asteroids years from now and doing exactly what you talked about. So, I mean, it's in the works, but they have to get to step one before they can get to step two. But there's a lot of people that plan on not only getting sample returns, but actually manufacturing stuff out of asteroids and the moon. And then you mentioned Psyche, that's the moon, the asteroid that's in orbit near Jupiter. So, as far as I know, there's going to be two spacecraft that just got the approval from NASA. You know, they decided on two spacecraft. One is called Psyche, because that's going to be going to that particular asteroid. And that's the one that's supposed to be all metal, solid metal. They're going to investigate that. I guess there's probably maybe no way to dig into the metal to bring something back. I don't know. Well, they might have plans on doing that. Nobody said that it's not going to be a sample return mission. And then with that mission, the same program, another spacecraft called Lucy, is going to be going out to the Trojan asteroids, probably in the L4 and eventually L5. They just float in orbit either directly ahead of Jupiter or behind it, not orbiting the planet, but going with it. So whether Lucy has some kind of sample return system on it or not, I haven't read that it does, but I haven't read that it doesn't either. You know, in the pictures that you see, you see a picture of Lucy, this very, very big solar panel, big platter, they're round, a big platter type of thing. They open up like a Japanese fan, Chinese fan, just by the size of it, it looked like it had to be 20 feet in diameter. So two big solar panels will open up on that to supply power. So what they're going to do with all this power, I know that it's reduced power out by Jupiter, it's probably going to get, maybe 400 watts an hour. But I don't think they need that much. Maybe they'll use some of that power and integrate it with an arm and bring back some kind of samples from that, from those asteroids. We'll see. Back to UK for any other comments, and then we'll see if Dick's still there. This is WS2M.
This is AC2LR. What I heard about the Lucy mission is it's actually going to visit a number of different asteroids. I heard an interview by one of the mission scientists last week ago, and she said that they're just going to fly over. And the smallest asteroid has so... I'm checking something about the... Any of them have magnetic fields or something to do with their gravity. So they have to get really close to the smallest of the asteroids to pick up anything, to be able to detect anything. And they're going to be something like 1,000 feet over the surface of it. But they're not taking samples. They have a trajectory plan to visit and fly past a number of different asteroids that interest them. And at least I just want to add that to what you... That's it from here.
This is AC2LR. Okay. Well, that confirms it. That's a shame. I guess they have a certain budget, and they have these different names, the Discovery Mission, the Frontier Mission, and all of these have certain budgets, and maybe they're not allowed to go past that, and they're happy with the equipment on board to be able to tell you exactly what kind of what these asteroids are made of. I guess it's good enough. It does get more involved with the sample returns, so very good. And anybody that listens to us should always check, look for the Limark Astronomy Net, and it's on a couple of Tuesdays a month. I think it's, I can never remember. I think it's the first and third Tuesday of the month, but sometimes that changes depending on whether Craig is available or not. The good thing about that is if they're unable to do a net, he rescheduled it. He'll move it. He'll float it a week in advance or something. So it's pretty good. Very informative. Let me see if Dick's out there. K2RIW, WS2N for the tech now.
You were going to go over the Russian material, Eric. I mean, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, you missed that. I went over that. I had about, I guess, 15 different comments, but if you didn't pick up on that, I could just go through them. Some of the things that you read from 1995 are interesting. The name of the Russian space program, when they called it RKA, but nowadays they call it Roscosmos. That's really their version of NASA. They had the Mir spacecraft up at that time, 1995. It was up for 10 years, but only occupied about 6 out of those 10 years. And it lasted another almost 5 years after that until they deorbited it. Dr. Norman Daggett, they sent him up, first American, let me drop it. First American to Mir. And they followed suit with maybe about a half a dozen more guys after that. And the shuttle started going up, docking with the Mir. And there were 5 missions with the shuttle. But Mir was there, bright joy. And but unfortunately, they had problems. Power problems was one of the problems. They would each module that they sent up had its own solar panels. They didn't have a truss section going out like we have on the ISS with at the very end. You have all these solar panels. Each module had them. And maybe they didn't think ahead. And in the article, it says they put them together. And then a lot of times the solar panels would block other solar panels. You know, it was an average of 40% they were losing all the time. It would be shaded, so they wouldn't have any power. So they would have brownouts, you might say, and they would, you know, in the middle of the day, it would shut itself down and drop it. I didn't mention it before, but the batteries always were failing, so they were constantly replacing the batteries. You know, they kept bringing them up on progress ships. It's a constant problem. All the piping and ductwork and things like that was all done on the inside of the space station, not on the outside. We learned a lesson from that. Everything was clogged up and messed, wind up with problems. And they designed the International Space Station with everything that's on the outside. That's where you see so many EVAs. That was another thing. Communications were very bad. They didn't have the teacher satellites, tracking data relay satellites that we have, or even had back then. So they would only contact the space station when it was overhead over Moscow. And that, you know, because of the inclination change as time went on, sometimes you'd get maybe 8 hours of communication, sometimes less. So Dr. Norm Daggett, American astronaut, he used ham radio. Anytime he'd fly over Houston, and it wasn't just to talk, you know, to his family or make QSL contacts. Nah, I mean, he used it as a backup system, and they would actually have conversations dealing with what was going on the space station problem. Russians had a lot of problems. They had fires on the space station. Eventually, they had to give it up, especially when the International Space Station started to be developed. But this article, you know, showed a lot of that. I mean, I went down a whole list of everything to talk about what they predicted back then. They thought they were going to have the bronze space shuttle developed by then, and that didn't happen. They had 2 launch facilities, Plesk in the north, and for launching rockets, and they had that, still do today, along with Baikonur down in the south, Kazakhstan. We drop it. And the this was all in these articles, and then they talked about, well, maybe we'll have this place in the north, in the far east of Russia, you know, I mean, getting close to the Pacific, a couple hundred miles off the Pacific. You know, we do have it. Well, you know, them, they have had ICBMs out there. Let's maybe use that place. Well, they went near it, a place called Boskochny. And back then they said, well, maybe we'll have it, according to the article, but they didn't have enough money. It didn't, according to the article, that was never going to be built. Well, it's all built today. They've actually launched a Soyuz rocket from it, and eventually they'll be launching people from that launch complex as well. A couple of, you know, maybe half a dozen years from now, they plan on building at least four launch complexes, two for humans, two for cargo. So these are some of the things I covered earlier, Dick, and there's some more, but I forgot. K2RFW, WS2N, very good articles from the IEEE Spectrum magazine.
Yeah, I was processing some old magazines and deciding whether or not I should keep them because they were filling up the house. I came across that article and said, I'm not going to throw that out. I'm going to send it to Paul. In the case of the Mir space station during its life, I think there were one or two incidents that were life-threatening. I believe one of them took place with an American astronaut on board. I think they had a fire on board on one occasion, and they had to go to these portable emergency oxygen backup system, sort of a face mask-like thing. As you can tell, I've only got a vague memory of some of their problems, and you probably could give me a lot more information on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
His last name, Gallivet L. I'll probably think of it later. But yeah, he was, the American astronaut was caught up there with them. Fires, they got the gas mask. They got into a situation where the Soyuz escape vehicle was on the opposite side. They couldn't get past the fire. So even if they wanted to escape, they couldn't. They had to get that fire out. They managed to do so. So they had quite a few problems. They had a leak in the Kaban module. They called it the Kaban module. And that, they had five modules attached up there. And what happened was the Progress ship was coming to dock to resupply here. And as it was coming in, they were supposed to, the command on the space station was supposed to be controlling this thing. As, you know, he's seen as if he was in the Progress coming toward the space station. And he got it all fouled up and ran into problems. He lost control of the Progress. And they couldn't slow it down fast enough. And it hit one of the solar panels and then put a hole in the Kaban module, so now you started losing pressure. Where's it coming from? And they couldn't figure out where the leak was. We dropped it. So they eventually closed that module off and never went into it again. So they had a lot of problems, but it was their pride, joy. It was up there when the article was written. What, 10 years? Occupied six out of those 10. And the people of Russia loved the Mir. And they didn't want to give it up. But, as you read the article, you realize that they had a lot of money problems. They just came out of 1991 where Soviet Union was came to an end. So, but then, you know, since then they've built things up a little bit. They're working on a new spacecraft called Federation, and they're launching rockets all over the place now, three different locations in Russia. They're launching out of French Guiana with cooperation of European Space Agency with the Soviet Soyuz spacecraft and rocket. So they've come a long way, and you know, not as far as, you know, their predictions. You know, even their predictions today, they were thinking about 2022 or so for the moon. Now it looks like it's gone to about 2028. Things get pushed back in that world. That's why it doesn't pay to follow the projections too much, because everything gets loaded some years down the road, even our own stuff. 5G Dick, WS2M.
When that progress wasn't properly controlled and smashed into the space station mirror and created a leak, from my point of view, they were very lucky that that leak was slow. If that injury to the space station had been greater, so that you got a an explosive decompression, I think that would have been game over for all the astronauts. There is no defense for that, isn't that true, Ripple? I mean, had that leak been, let me pick a number, 10 times faster, I think there's no way they could have corrected it in time. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
I know it was pretty bad because they did have to make a decision pretty quick on closing the hatch to the Kavan module. So they must have been losing pressure real fast. And it's not a question of, you know, just losing oxygen. And, you know, yeah, you can throw a gas mask, oxygen mask on to get through that, but they're losing pressure, you know, so, you know, it's game over. You know, you breathe in all the oxygen you want. If you're sitting there in a vacuum, you're toast. So somebody made a quick decision to close that thing. And the fire was another issue. And I think the fire was caused, I think they said it was actually caused from one of these oxygen burning candles. I don't know why they needed it. I think they were getting low or something. I don't know what happened. But I think it came from one of those. I'll have to check. I don't think it was electronics or anything like that. So. Okay, Dick, over to you, and we'll be here for any other comments or questions. Back to you.
From your description, I'm guessing that the leaking module was one of the end modules, and therefore you can just close the door to it. Had it been a middle module, it didn't have that option. Is that true, Paul? K2LAW?
Yeah,
it's
a you had like one main module. It was the living quarters. It was the one first put up there, and that would be the one that they were docking to. And then that went into like a node where you could put, you know, four different modules off of that. But they would be independent, you know. So you would go inside, let's say, this room, and it would be like three or four doors, you know. Door number one leads to the command module. Don't go in that one anymore. That one's closed off. Door number two goes into Spectre. Spectre is another science module that they had, and, you know, that type of thing. So the only one that they would have been really in trouble would have been that, you know, that first one, the living quarter one, because that was the one that was attached to the Soyuz spacecraft. And that was the way out. So as long as it hit one of the other ones, I guess they were okay. You know, they weren't in line, like, pretty well. Most of ours are in line today. Although when you get to the front end of it, you drop it. Then it starts to tee off, you know, your main modules. You know, from the back to the front, you got your Russian modules, you got your module. That's the one where you have your propulsion and your living quarters with the Russians. And that turn is, you know, attached to the functioning cargo block. And that's the one with all the batteries and gyros and guidance equipment, all that stuff. It's like a machine room. And then you go forward of that, you know, you go in line, and now you come to Unity, which is a large American node with six different doors on there. So, and again, you keep going down the run, and that attaches to Destiny. And then from Destiny, you keep going down that run. Destiny is a large American module. That's where we have all our science stuff. And then you keep going, and then you're into another node called Harmony. And Harmony is another big area where you have all these different doors. Let me drop it. And that would be your way out. If you had an American spacecraft at Hatcher, that's where the shuttle, one of the ports the shuttle used to go to. You go out the run of that module, and that's the PMA, pressure mating adapter number 2. You leave that, and you would be in the shuttle, or in the future, you'd be in the Dragon crewed spacecraft. You can get out that way. Well, you go all the way through all those runs and go all the way out the back, and you can get to out the back end of Zvezda. You'd be into the Soviet spacecraft. Now, they have a node in between the Zvezda and the functioning cargo block, the Zarya unit. Now, that comes down, and they go to a couple of other modules, which has additional either spacecraft or progress vehicles attached to it. So that's not a long run. But the front end of the American end, once you get to the front end where the space shuttle used to dock, you can go left or right. If you go right, you're into this large module called Columbus module. And that was another one sent up by the European Space Agency. If you were going to go contact people on Earth for the ARIES program, the Amateur Radio on International Space Station program, that's where you would go, and you would be in there, and you'd have a radio in the Columbus module to talk down to all the people on Earth, all the hams on Earth. But instead of going that way, you went the other way, you made a left when you were in that node. Instead of going to the Columbus module, you'd be going to something called the Kibo module. That's the largest module of the whole space station. And Kibo is put up there by Japan. If you see all the pictures, a lot of the pictures from the space station when they're having interviews with, you know, with different TV stations, you'll see them. That's usually where it's taking place, in the Kibo module. They also have an airlock in that module, which they're able to send out CubeSats. And they put them in the airlock, and push it through, and the robotic arm would take it out. They have a small robotic arm that, you know, is set up by Japan that's utilized for that purpose. They have a lot of robot arms. So you have that, and then now if you come back, you're going along that run, you come out of the Kibo, and you go back to the node, Harmony node, you go back to Destiny, through the Big American Lab. Let me drop it. And then normally you would have went into Unity and kept on going. You stop at Unity and put the brakes on and make a right, and you could find yourself into the Tranquility node. Tranquility node, that's where you, inside that, they have a bunch of different doors there. One of them goes to the cupola. You go in there, put two people in there if you want, and you can look out these six windows, these trapezoidal windows, and you can see everything. You can see the Earth, you can see the docking systems that are going on, you can see your robotic arm out there, and then make a turn from that, you can go into the inflated Bigelow module. That's the one that Bigelow sent up there, and they puffed up like a big balloon. And then on the American side, anyway, if you want to do a spacewalk, you come across back into, you leave the Tranquility node and go into the back into the Unity node. Just keep going, 180 degrees right across, and you'll come into the Quest module. It's really like two rooms, one big room, and then it goes to a very small room where that's where you put your spacesuits on and you decompress and open the door and go for a spacewalk. So, big difference from the 5 modules that Mir had, and the 10, or actually really 11 now, because Bigelow. A lot of living quarters, a lot of living space on the International Space Station. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2M.
I think you've told us that the International Space Station runs at an air pressure equal to Earth, 14.7 pounds per square inch. Did Mir run at the same pressure, or did they run at a lower pressure, is question number one. Question number two, I am guessing there's an automatic system that maintains pressure. In other words, there must be a compressed tank somewhere that is slowly opened automatically in order to maintain whatever the set pressure is for the spacecraft. And in the case of the leak in Mir, because of the Progress that collided with it, there must have been an alarm that went off because the rate at which the air pressure was being replaced must have been excessive, and therefore the automatic machinery set off an alarm. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. So what was the pressure, and how did they find out they had a leak? I guess they had a node to inspect everything, because there must have been a hell of a bang when the Progress crashed into the Mir. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I think they were running the same pressures. I know they had very heavy space craft in the beginning with the Soyuz and the Vostok and all. I mean, those things were very thick, very big. I think they first got involved with that. Where we wanted to send, well, like the early Mercury flights were, you know, pure oxygen. Yeah. So, until later on after the Apollo 1 fire, and then we decided to go, you know, go with a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen. And then they decided on the space station, you know, we were hooked up to the Russians. We wanted to keep the same pressures. That's, you know, these things evolved, you know, for space walks, of course, they have lower pressure. I think it's 4.3 on the EVA suits. Yeah, and to make up pressure, well, they weren't going to make up that. I know the pressure was dropping, so whatever tanks they had, we're not going to make it up fast enough. On the International Space Station, you do have big oxygen tanks surrounding the Quest Lab. I mean, massive things. And I'm sure they could use that to regulate the pressure in the spacecraft. They definitely use it for all the EVAs. You know, you're going to lose some air. They're always going to make it up with that. And they have a electrolysis going on up there all the time.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Change from. They didn't have all that with Mir. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, I'm suddenly curious about how pressure and mixture is properly maintained. You've got all your astronauts on board breathing in oxygen and exhaling carbon dioxide. In the case of spacecraft, you've got lithium hydroxide canisters. You've got some kind of filters that are scrubbing the air, removing the carbon dioxide. But that requires a continuous replacement of filters. On the International Space Station, I bet you they're doing something a little bit more automatic than that. So by some means, carbon dioxide is being removed, and oxygen is continuously being replaced, and there must be some kind of an automatic system that not only maintains the pressure, but maintains the right ratio of oxygen to nitrogen. Could you describe some of that, Paul? How does that whole system work? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, well, it evolved, you know, the early Gemini flights, Mercury flights, they had no way of creating oxygen, you know. It was just, you know, that's why they had one of the reasons they had short missions, outside of the fact that they really didn't know what they were doing and they didn't want to leave them up there too long. But then you got to Gemini 5, and they said, well, we want to have longer missions. We got to go to the moon and come back. We need at least 10 days or 14 days for, you know, insurance. How are we going to do this? So they developed the fuel cells to, you know, instead of running off of batteries, they needed fuel cells. Well, the fuel cells, the byproduct of those things is water. They make a lot of water. So it was only, you know, the next step, what do I do with all this water?